So the title of this conference was, I think, The Universe in the Palm of Your Hand, right? I'm the one who gave it that title, because they asked me for something, and I had to give them something, so I did. Because the universe, you're thinking, well, the universe isn't really in the palm of my hand, right? Or maybe you're thinking, oh, that sounds good. The universe is in the palm of my hand. I would like to hear about that. The fact is that the universe is everywhere. That also sounds good, but maybe doesn't really, you don't really believe it, or you don't feel it here, but okay, you'll listen to that too. When I say the universe is in the palm of your hand, it means that it's right here, the universe. What do we mean by universe? What do we mean by palm of my hand? What do we mean by here? When I say it's everywhere, what do I mean by everywhere? We have a lot of ideas about the words and the definitions. Images, the universe. We think of something vast with stars in the sky and many planets. What's that? Okay. We think of it as being eternal, but we have clocks. We think of it, okay, it's endless, but there's an upstairs and there's a downstairs and there's an inside and there's an outside. How does that all fit together? On my way here, just about half an hour ago, I have been in a retreat all week, and so have not heard any television, radio, internet, nothing, no news from the outside world. And so Anna Christina was in the car and she said, did you hear that there was an earthquake in Italy? And was telling us about it. And then said, and did you hear that this factory has closed down in Portugal, and it has a direct impact on her life? And then someone said, it's very bad for the economy of Portugal. So this factory that means I'd never heard of it before in my life has a direct impact on the life of someone who I do know, because her husband works there. It has a direct impact on other people who work there, and then it has, as someone said, on the economy of Portugal, because her husband buys a car. She buys food. Her husband fills up the car with gasoline. Someone bought the gas to put in the car. Someone made the car that he bought. Someone made the road that he drives the car on. Someone built the house. And Christina has to eat. And so someone grew the food that she will buy at the supermarket. And the son was involved in helping the plants to grow so that someone could make bread, so that there could be wheat, and then we'd have bread, and then we would eat the bread. And the clouds and the rain were also involved in that. And if we know a little bit about science, we know that the clouds and rain and the rivers and the oceans and the sun and the dew on the plants all are related. But we are also related. If there were not the sun, there would not be the earthquake in Rome. Of course, we don't see that connection as directly, but as I pointed out of the closing of the factory and the effect it has on the economy, an endless number of effects, which will also affect the town where the factory is, but then the country at large, which will then have an effect on Spain, because it borders Portugal, and then it will have a greater effect on, I come from France, there are a lot of Portuguese people in France, they will somehow be affected more directly than me, probably, because they have relatives, or a business that they have was doing business with that factory. They may just know someone and they hear about it. That affects their how they feel in that moment, and then how they react to the person that they next speak to on the telephone. Maybe what products they buy, and then something else will be affected. Eventually, the entire European Union will be affected. There was talk of possibly China buying the patents from the factory. China suddenly becomes involved. The world economy is a good example of what I'm talking about. Okay, as we all know that it's in crisis at the moment. There's a global economic crisis. And this is a very vivid example of how one thing is dependent on another. The global economic crisis, as we all know. Someone bought stocks in America in an insurance company, and immediately that has an effect on someone in Switzerland because that insurance company was in fact owned by a company in Switzerland, and if it fails, then the person loses the value of the stocks, drops. We all know how this works. But this also works in terms of all phenomena, in terms of our very being. None of us is an isolated being, phenomena. No phenomena is isolated. No phenomena could exist without the others. We also were having a discussion this afternoon about living alone. I live in an apartment by myself, Claudia tells me. We think of ourselves as living alone. But in fact, we don't really live alone. We just, within a certain contour of four walls, we live alone in that space. But when I was in a room in her apartment, I could hear on the other side of the wall children talking. So just this far away was someone else, another human being. So physically, in fact, very close. Just outside, there are people walking by, and we are connected with them. We hear their voice. They are looking in the window of the building in which they're looking at the books in the window. We are in this building. We're affected by that. We don't feel it, but the fact that this wall is here and they are on that side and I am on this side, we have a relationship. We each have a different relationship to this wall and to this building, but we're sharing a relationship to this building. And we share a relationship with every being everywhere. There are relative degrees to that relationship. You maybe read the paper with my name and picture, and you already had a relationship with me. You read about me. I had entered your awareness. I didn't know specifics of who the faces would be here, but I knew I was coming here to this place where I have been before. I had already entered into relationship with you. You had already entered my being my awareness because we were going to share this moment. Even if I never arrived, maybe the car broke down and we didn't arrive. The people who aren't here, someone called just before, and someone who I know, and said he had wanted to come, but he couldn't. At the last minute, something had drawn him away. He's here with me right now. He's here. I'm talking about him. Adriano, he's here. He entered my life. He entered the universe that I consider the universe. But the fact is, he was never outside it. It's not only what is in our awareness that is part of the universe. Where do you draw the line to where the universe is and where it isn't? You say, I can tell you it's in the palm of your hand. Well, how far does the palm of your hand extend? Where is the edge of the universe? Where does it begin? Where does it end? It doesn't. It's endless. It's as endless as the palm of my hand. The palm of my hand is endless because it's not limited to what I think of as the palm of my hand. As this room is limited only by the walls that we have constructed, but they're artificial, if you will. That it's a false limit. Beyond the walls is still part of the same space, it's just been divided. We can divide it as we do with our being, with ourselves. We divide ourselves up. I like this, I don't like that. I make rooms in myself, some that I like better than others. I make different, I have an upstairs and a downstairs, and the things I really don't like I put way down in the basement, even maybe under a cement floor. I really don't like those things. I think I'm getting rid of them, but they're in the same house. They're in the same universe. The things I really like I might put on the outside, or I think that I'm putting them on the outside so that people will see them. People see the things I don't like too. In fact, they usually see them better than I do. So sometimes I will say the universe is everywhere. That's the bad news because there's nowhere to go. You can't get away. Wherever you go, you're still in the universe. There is no way out. It's funny how sometimes I see people driving in a car and, or even walking down the street, and they open a package, a piece of gum, put it in their mouth and throw the paper. They throw it out the car door, out the window. It's gone. It's not gone. It's just been put, it's just been moved over. It's just like this. Okay, it's there. Instead of here. I don't see it anymore. So it doesn't exist, but that's not true. It's still there. The same is true of myself, so I build these walls within myself, and I do the same thing between myself and others. Because I have this basic belief that I can separate us. In fact, I believe we are separated already. And in order to maintain that separation, because then I would feel safe, I build walls, more and more, stronger walls, higher, deeper, wider, more elaborate, more walls. Just four is not enough, I have to build extra ones and put complicated protections on top of them, and maybe even install guns, cameras to survey the situation, to be sure that everyone stays out. It's a losing battle because we're not separate. So, like the universe is everywhere, We're not separate. We're all one. So you can put up all the walls you want. It's like this. So you still have a relationship with the person that's just one, you're just both on one side of the wall, opposite sides of the wall. And in fact, there really aren't two sides. So when I say we're not separate, you're thinking, okay, what does that mean? I'm not you. I don't look like you. I don't talk like you. I don't know what you're talking about. I'm not, when we were talking about the earthquake in Rome, someone mentioned Berlusconi, and everyone immediately thought, oof, I'm not Berlusconi. or maybe someone thought, oh yeah, I like Berlusconi. Probably not, but not in the car I was riding in. Maybe in the next car someone else was thinking they liked Berlusconi. But hey, you know, I'm Berlusconi too. We all are. I don't have that name, I don't have that physical appearance, but what separates me from Berlusconi? The fact that he speaks Italian and I speak English? The fact that he's a man and I'm a woman? That's like upstairs and downstairs. That's like this side of the river and the other side of the river. We're one. Now, at the same time, we can say we're very different. That's true. He's a man, I'm a woman. Basic, fundamental difference. But the nature of our being is the same. An unlimited combination of events and phenomenon combine to give us this being that we call Silviano Berlusconi. A different combination of phenomenon results in this one. Or in that one, or in that one, in that one, in this one. Like if I pour this on the table, it will have a different appearance, but it's water. The nature is the same. It takes a different form. If I put it in the freezer and it freezes and it's ice, it takes a different form, but the nature is the same. It's water, or what we call water. In Portuguese, you call it something else. Água, or something, yeah. We call it something different, but the nature is the same. And that's what I'm talking about. That's, each of us has the same nature. We appear to be different, but we have the same nature. And all phenomena as well. And we are not, even the ice is not solid. We think of it as being solid. An unlimited combination of events created that ice. Like I demonstrated with the effect of a factory closing in Portugal. I can't even begin to list all of the consequences of one event and all of the actions resulting in one event. Sometimes I try to figure out how is it that I ended up living in France. I was born in America. I lived in America for 20 years, first 20 years of my life, and then I moved to France. How did this happen? And I can think, okay, I had a French teacher and I liked studying French, and then one summer I didn't know what to do, so I went to study in France and I loved it. After I finished university, I didn't know what to do, so I went back to France. Okay, possible. But farther than that, if I trace it even back, farther. My father liked France. He was a soldier there in the Second World War. Farther. My grandfather liked France. He was a soldier there in the First World War. Farther. Maybe nothing to do with my family, or maybe nothing to do with studying French. I had a boyfriend who was going to France, and so I liked him, and so I thought it was a good idea. I met that boyfriend because we worked in a restaurant together. I worked in that restaurant because my sister knew someone who worked there. My sister knew him because she went to high school with his girlfriend. We went to that high school because my parents chose to live in this. Okay? I've traced this back to Napoleon, in fact. And that's not far enough, probably, right? Because one part of my ancestors fled Europe because they didn't want their sons to serve in Napoleon's armies. And they moved to America. But then we have to trace how Napoleon came to be. And then we have to trace how the causes of Napoleon coming to be. We would have to study the French Revolution, which is really complicated and no one wants to study it. And we would have to then study the French character and how the French Revolution could be so different from the American Revolution. And then we would probably have to look at the Russian Revolution. Endless. The causes and the effects are endless. The point is that it's all connected. Everything is connected with everything else. Us being here tonight, we're connected. We all came here for the same reason. And some of us know each other, some of us don't. Now we're all connected. We were before too, but in a way that we didn't understand as concretely, right? There's a child here, and she, who knows what her life will be? But she's connected with this and will be forever. She was before. She was connected before she was born with this because she's connected with her mother, and her mother was connected with us before she was even here. In ways that we can't see. It's such, so infinite and so subtle that we can't see it. But we don't need to. All we need to see is what's right here now. It's all right here. That's what I say, the universe is in the palm of your hand. Napoleon Bonaparte is here in my hand. You're saying, okay, wait a minute, I lost you. Good. Because it's not about understanding it with your mind, with your head, with your intellect. It's about experiencing it. And the way that you experience the universe is by seeing the palm of your hand. By seeing the eyes of the person across from you. By tasting the water. By seeing the sun setting. I don't know if you can see it. By seeing the clouds, the heavy clouds. By experiencing the feel of the chair, by hearing the bird song, where we were on retreat, there was an amateur or band that was rehearsing regularly, a brass band, and we heard it in a way that we would not have heard it had we not been sitting there in silence hour after hour, day after day. We had an attention to it that we would not have had otherwise. And the woman who was at this place where we were doing the retreat, who had nothing to do with any of this, but was affected by the silence, because we were silent and so she was too, said this morning, she told us that she started hearing sounds differently. She heard the water in the pipes differently. She heard it for the first time. Maybe she had heard it before without really paying any attention because there was this silence. And because there was the silence, we could hear this orchestra, this band playing, and we could hear even the individual horns. And someone was saying how he thought, you know, it was a different horn this morning than it was a few nights ago. And everyone was thinking, oh yes, and they were trying to do this, and they were trying to do that, but we were really hearing it. Because we were silent. We weren't so caught up in whatever else. We didn't have our iPods on, which are what we do most of the time, even if we don't really have an iPod. We have our own little shuffle going in there. But when we sit down in silence, we just sit there. We just sat there for 6 days. We did nothing. We didn't do it. We just sat there. Of course, we did other things. We ate. We slept. We worked together. We cooked together. We cleaned the toilets. We listened to me talk, which was too much, I think, but I even listened to myself talk, which was really too much. And then this afternoon on the computer, I listened to it again, and really too much. Basically, we just sat there. Now, in our daily life, we can't just sit there. We have things we have to do, right? You go home, you have to do the laundry, you have to go shopping, you have to go to the bank, you have to go to your job, you have to talk to your partner, deal with your children, many, many things you have to do. However, that doesn't mean you can't listen. And you can't be attentive. It's possible. There is silence in the middle of a busy street. In Paris, I ride the subway a lot, all the time. And if I pay attention, and when I say silence, it doesn't mean that there's not noise, but I can hear it. In a way, if I pay attention and not separate myself from it, it's not noise. It's what I am. It's just what is. Some of it's louder than others. The bus going by makes more noise than the car. When the cars and the buses stop, it's different. When I stop talking, it's different. When I start talking, it's different. But we can bring the same attention and hear the essence of whatever is being said or done in the same way. Which allows us to experience the universe right here. Which allows us to experience things as they are, without what we add to it, which means without separating. When I say separate, I mean good and bad, for example. That's a separation immediately, good and bad. Loud and soft is also a separation. To notice the differences is to separate. But when we attach a judgment to it is when we start having problems. That's why when I say good and bad, then we start having problems. And we miss then how things are interconnected. Because we don't want the bad things. And so we push them away. And we miss how that is related to me. I once did a retreat in Auschwitz, which is a very powerful place and represents what we think of as one of the greatest evils of modern times, and has been kept as a reminder of that has been kept basically intact as it was left in 1945 as a reminder of that. And so we went and we sat there for 5 days on the tracks where the trains arrived and people came out and were separated. Some were sent to the chambers to die and others were sent to work to death. And we sat there for 5 days. And we would walk into the barracks where the people had lived, if you can call that living. It was life, that's true. We went and visited what's left of the gas chambers. We saw the ovens. We saw the wall where people were executed. And when we went to that wall, and we were very much identifying with the suffering of the victims, which is natural. We all do. Very natural. We can all feel that, what that must have been like. And when we went to the execution wall, among our group was a man who had been a soldier in Vietnam, an American soldier. And he said to us, "Come and stand here." And he was standing where the executioner would have stood. And we did. And that was a different experience. That was equally as powerful as standing against the wall with the gun pointed at you, as standing in the place where the executioner was standing, pointing the gun. And he said to us, "Look up. All this time we've been looking down and around. Look up to the towers where the guards were." What was that like? It's more difficult for us to put us in that position because we really don't want to acknowledge that aspect of ourselves. We really don't want to know, "I could execute someone. I could torture someone. I could send someone to the gas chamber." That is out of sight. That's in the basement under the cement floor, right? But when we were in this intense experience of actually being there, it was possible to experience that. And to see, one night one woman said, "You know, I have realized that all of my life I have been doing Auschwitz to myself in my head. I've been doing a concentration camp to myself. This part of me is unacceptable. It's not good. I will kill it. I want everything in myself to look like this, to be blonde with blue eyes of German, pure German blood. And whatever is a Jew or a gypsy or a homosexual or a dissident or an artist or handicapped, no." She realized she was doing that to herself. And if you think about it, we all do it. As soon as we start making these separations, throwing things out the window to an outside of the universe, trouble starts. Of course, it's an exaggeration. Auschwitz is the extreme. But it's what happens when we don't see the oneness, when we don't see the universe right here now. It's a possible result. It's a consequence of our actions of separation. And what I experienced as the executioner, was that if I truly experienced that I was not different from the other, that I am one, that I share the same nature as the other, I would put down the gun. I could not execute someone because we were one. We would be killing myself. And the fact of killing is coming from this basic delusion of not seeing my oneness, and it's painful. It's very painful to be isolated. You live alone, and people say, why do you live alone? Ooh, I wouldn't want to live alone. It's frightening to be alone. And yet, that's what we do. We close ourselves off. And because we need to, if we don't see that we are one with the other, if we don't see that we all share one universe, that we all are of the same nature, it's painful. It's difficult. That's where our basic suffering comes from. And all of the things that we have to do to then, it's weird because we don't like it, but everything we do is in order to maintain it. We don't like feeling alone and empty and cut off. And yet everything we do is cutting ourselves off from the oneness of all things. So as I said, we sat for 6 days and did nothing, which was a way of, if this water were full of sand, most of our daily life is spent like this, all messed up, cloudy. And when you sit down for 6 days, it settles. The sand settles to the bottom and you can begin to see, the water clears. And in a sense, we don't realize that it's happening, actually. Well, we're sitting there for 6 days, we don't realize it. And we experience it as it's not that big a deal because it's our natural state, in fact. What's bizarre. But this is really the natural state. Sometimes this happens, right? There's an earthquake. So this happens. The camera doesn't work, so there's a little turbulence. But, okay. The camera doesn't work. We don't need to have a film. And it settles again. I'm sure in Italy, with the earthquake, it hasn't settled yet. People died, and people probably will continue to die. And they don't have water, and they can't go to their homes. And they're maybe missing some people from their family, and any number of consequences. And we're hearing about it, so we're affected by it. I actually had heard about it beforehand, but I didn't get the full story. And so I already was affected by it. And my son, who told me about it, who had been in Rome the day before and was leaving that night when the earthquake happened, had been affected in a different way. And when I gave the example of the camera not working, okay, we don't need a phone. That seems pretty easy, right? Okay, now I can let go of that. We don't need a film. But maybe someone was really attached to having a film. I don't know. And maybe we can say, yes, but if we had had a film, then we could have put it on the internet and someone would have seen it, and then that's these consequences. Well, something else will happen now. And who's to judge? There's a story that we tell in Buddhist circles of maybe it's an old Jewish story. Anyway, in a village there's a farmer. He has one son, and he needs his son to help him work in the fields in order so that he can produce his crop and that he can sell it and live. And his son, one day, is out with his friends. I don't know what they're doing. They're at the pub or something. And on the way home, the son breaks his leg and can't work in fields. And the farmer is so upset and so angry at his son. And this causes huge problems because he can't then have the same harvest that he could have had otherwise, and therefore he doesn't have as much money to support his family, and he may have to pay someone else to help him, and then even if he did have the same size harvest, he would have less money because he would have to pay, and there's consequences to this. He's very angry and upset and very angry with his son. And his son feels bad and guilty and not a happy family. I don't know, a few weeks later, along comes the king's troops, and they are recruiting, not even by choice, they're taking every able-bodied young man to join the king's army and go off to fight a war. Well, the man's son can't go because he has a broken leg. And the man is overjoyed that his son has a broken leg, because he doesn't have to go off to war. And the regiment goes off to war, and in fact, none of them come back. They were all wiped out. So in fact, the fact that this young man broke his leg, it saved his life. Although his father had thought that it was going to ruin his life, and that they would all suffer immensely because of it, but in fact, it was wonderful. This is not a story to say that, as we say, every cloud has a silver lining. That's not what this means. It doesn't mean that there's always a happy ending. It means that because everything is interconnected, everything is, we say, interdependent, there will be an effect. Everything will cause an effect, and we don't know what that will be, and we can't judge it as we normally would. Of course, we can appreciate the consequences, but we can't say if it's good or bad, in fact. On one hand, it's good, and on the other hand, it's bad. And what does bad mean? And what does good mean? Maybe had that young man gone off to war, he would have become a hero and saved the entire regiment, and then joined the king's court, and the family would have had untold riches. Who knows? We don't know. But that's not what happened. In fact, the story is maybe not even true, but it sounds good, right? It's a good example. All of this is just to say that the universe is right here now in the palm of your hand. And experiencing that is not something extraordinary, like I said. It's not something impossible. It's not something only some people can experience and others not. It's available to every single person at every single moment, no matter where they are, who they are, what language, what age, what country, what social standing. No separation. There's no categories. It's right here now. And so it's available to everyone who is ever here. But wherever you are is here. You know, if I said to you, if you're not here, please raise your hand. Well, I've seen that happen, however. I've been in a group where people have raised their hand. And we laugh, and everyone thinks it's really funny, but they're not experienced. They don't feel like they're really here. They don't feel like they're really present. And it's very honest in a group like this to raise your hand and say, no, I don't feel like I'm here. I'm not present. And that's why. We create our own separation. We decide if we're here or not. It's not in a conscious way, of course. It involves letting go of our ideas about here and our ideas about the universe and our ideas, first of all, about ourselves. And because everything is interdependent, as we've seen, the universe is in this bottle. I mean, I'm not sure exactly technically how plastic is made, but we can easily trace any number of situations to the man who drove the truck that delivered the bottle, to the man who made the truck, to the rubber for the tires, and then the rubber plantation in Brazil, and the sun and the rain again. And the same is true of us. So when we say, I am not solid, this I, me, is also a combination of an unlimited amount of phenomena. Nothing solid. It's changing all the time as well. Which is like everybody else. And that's where we can't even really draw the line. It's all right here. Any questions or comments, or is this what you wanted to hear, or is this what you?
I have a question, just related to that, because I can understand rationally the idea that we are all interconnected and that in fact there is no reason to judge because in fact we're all the same. In any case, everything is a process of ever-changing. And so any judgment that we make is just bound to disappear anyway. But my problem is when you have to make moral choices, when you have to make choices where you have to say, no, this is wrong, this is right, feel sorry for someone and decide to help someone because you think that he or she is being a victim of some sort of injustice. And so how are you supposed to react in these situations when faced with this sort of like a moral, if it is a moral sort of universe?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. This is usually the first question that comes up when we have this kind of discussion. And it's legitimate, absolutely legitimate. And it's actually good that it comes up because then it allows us to see it from another perspective, which is actually not another perspective, but it casts it in a different light. So, take a very simple example. You're walking down the street and a child is playing with a ball, and the ball, somehow one of the boys kicks it into the street and the other child runs after the ball into the street, and there's a car coming. Probably, say it's a hypothetical situation, probably you would act like that, grab the child, if it was possible, if you were on the other side of the river and you saw it, no, you couldn't. But if you were there and you saw that happen, you would grab the child and there would be no question, no thought. Obvious. You wouldn't be thinking, is this right or wrong? Will I look good when I'm running into the street? Is that child worthy of being saved? Should I blame that child for running into the street? He should know better. Should I condemn his mother for not having told him not to run in the street? Should I yell at the other boy who kicked the ball in the street? Should I yell at the guy in the car because he's not stopping soon enough? None of these things are happening. Act directly. If those things were happening, if you were thinking, oh, well, I don't have on Converse, I need Converse to run into the street. Or my hair will be messed up if I run into the street. No, you're not thinking these things. If you were, there would be a delay in your action. And you might not even act based on these judgments you have about the right shoes or the wrong shoes, or the condemning the mother for not telling the kid, or yelling at the boy for kicking the ball, or even thinking, oh yeah, that's an Adidas ball, I don't like those, let them, they can run over that. Or that boy is black, he's not as important if he was white, so forget it. None of those judgments are coming in. Okay, this sounds really simple, obvious, right? In fact, every situation is as direct, as simple. Of course, the details can appear more complex, and they are. You know, sometimes you don't know. Like you say, what do you do? If you have a fixed position from which you're acting, you have less of a chance of acting appropriately than if you are open to the situation. If you had a fixed idea about saving a boy in the street or not, you would have less of a chance of acting directly. So it's our fixed positions that we bring, our opinions, ideas, strong sense of self, looking good, not looking good, being right, being wrong, knowing better, not knowing better. It's all of those things that are complicating the situation for us. We give another example that I use all the time. So for people who've heard me talk a lot, they've probably heard these examples, but it doesn't matter. You hear them differently. If I have this belief that I should not lie, it's morally wrong to lie, right? I have this very strong position not to lie. And I'm living in Paris in 1943. And my neighbors are Jewish, and they've had to flee their home, and they're hiding in my attic. And the police come to the door and say, we've heard that you have a Jewish family hiding here. Is that true? If I lie, if I want to save the life of these people, if I lie, I'm doing something that's morally wrong according to my strict standard of what is morally correct. If I don't lie, if I tell the truth, these people will die. They will be taken away and sent off to Auschwitz. So what do you do? Do you stick to your fixed position? What's right or wrong? It's probably not an easy situation, probably because your own life is at stake. If they find out that you're lying, well then you'll go off with the Jewish family to Auschwitz. I use this example because we can say, oh, that's really clear too. Of course you'd lie, probably. Of course you wouldn't be bound by some moral code that says that. Or, anyone who's a parent knows that there are things that you don't tell your children. There are things that aren't appropriate to tell your children. Or there are things that aren't appropriate to tell your colleagues about your private life. Or if someone has confided in you with some secret about their life, it's not appropriate to tell someone else about it, and therefore you may need to lie. But if you're bound by this rule of not lying, you will do things that aren't appropriate. However, if you act according to the circumstances, you have a much better chance of acting appropriately. In fact, you will act with what we call right action. Not right as opposed to wrong, but right in the sense that it all fits together. It's elegant. It's the elegant solution, which is not necessarily beautiful. Lying is not necessarily beautiful, but it might be the right solution. There's a story also in the of the person whom we call the Buddha. He is just a person like the rest of us, but he would tell a story of someone that he had known who had been in a situation where there was an assassin who was killing people. And in order to save the lives of the people that this man was threatening, he had to kill him. So he probably had a moral judgment that killing was wrong, but in order to save a number of other lives, he had to kill. That's something that could happen to any of us. We don't know. But if we come to the situation with a fixed idea of not killing, well, then we risk killing many other people as a result. In that sense, what is right and wrong? What is good and bad? It's changing all the time. What the right response is changing all the time. And so we are called upon to change all the time as well, to be so flexible that we can react accordingly. And in order to be that flexible, we have to drop all of the stuff we're hanging on to. If I was attached to this chair and I tried to drag this chair back to Paris with me, I would have a hard time. They probably wouldn't let me on the airplane. But if I thought this chair was the most precious thing in my life and needed to have it with me at every moment, well, I would be stuck. I would probably not leave this room for the rest of my life. They would throw me out, and then I would have lost my job, and there would be innumerable consequences, right? Does that...
Yeah, it does. My question, I think, is just if you had made the choice of telling this couple that, yes, there are some people hiding in the attic of the building, you would perhaps feel morally that person, or maybe not. But my question is whether it matters anyway if you feel right or wrong, or if you feel the good or bad thing, if there is not sort of a moral, like eternal moral law, or kind of like that. Punishment or a reward or that kind of thing. Do you understand what I'm saying?
As a result of my action, is there a...
I remember reading recently a haiku by a Zen monk called Basho, where he was saying, I'm not sure if I interpreted the haiku appropriately, but he was saying that he passed on his way to a mountain. He passed by a river and he saw a child that had been clearly abandoned by his parents. And the child was, you know, on a diet because he doesn't know how to survive and so on. But he decided to not take the child with him or take care of the child. He just decided to leave him there because, and as far as I understood, was, you know, if such horrible thing had happened, was because that was the way of things. And, you know, it's sort of like, kind of like things happen, and, you know, are you supposed to interfere with them? You know, does it matter to make any moral choice to actually save the life of this child? Because that's just the way things are, and eventually, you know, it's all going to fade and transform and morph into something else.
The notion of does it matter And is it, you know, that's the way of things? Is there some established way or something? What I say is that there are consequences. So there is a consequence to not, so not stopping for the child. There's a consequence. And there would be a consequence if he did stop for the child. Different consequences.
Right.
Consequence if you give up, if you tell them, yes, there's Jews in my house, or if there's not. And what that consequence is, we can't know beforehand. And we don't really need to know what the consequence is. We know that there will be a consequence. If I go like that, the ball, I know that there will be a consequence. If I let it go, it will roll off. If I don't, then it comes back. There's consequences. Whether those consequences are good or bad in a moral sense comes back to the same question of, well, okay, so then is it bad for the Jewish family to die? I don't know. How could you judge it? There will be another consequence from that. The child left by the river. Is that bad or good? How can you judge that? If it's whether it's bad or good, it's like saying, where do you draw the line of the universe? Where does it end? You can try to, of course, and we do. We do. We try to separate. We do try to say this is bad and this is good. And we get into trouble. Trouble in the sense that we fail endlessly. We say it's like having a glass that we want to keep clean. And so we constantly keep it clean, and then we say, well, finally, I'm not going to use it because I want it to stay clean. But it will gather dust anyway, the glass. And just by its existence, from the elements, it will become dirty, as we say. So we have to clean it again. We put it down again. So we have our choice. Shall we use it? Profit from the glass? Experience drinking water from it? Appreciate its beauty and the craftsmanship in it and how well it looks and how well it works with wine? I don't know. And wash it every time we use it? Or shall we just let it sit there and watch it and then clean it from time to time and have this idea that certain things in it are good and certain things that are bad, and so then we won't fully appreciate it? That's a metaphor for our life. If we draw these lines and say we shouldn't do this and we should do that, we limit very much what has no limit. And we don't experience the totality. We don't experience fully life. It's true. You know, we fall down. Things get dirty. We make mistakes. They do matter. There are consequences, and it does matter. It does matter if the glass is dirty or clean. And we clean it. But of course, there are consequences, yes. But is there a fixed moral code? Nothing's fixed.
I think I have a similar question. How do you know what is the limit point to accept things and behaviors?
You mean how long should you sit there while you don't like what someone is doing, or yeah?
Yeah.
If you experience who you really are, if you experience things, the world as it is, if you come to it, if you are it, without the separations, there's no doubt. You know, it's clear what is right and what is not. What is acceptable, what is not acceptable. The more, and we say that the more that we practice, the more that we sit, just sitting there, letting it settle, it becomes clear. It's like the water. the more that all of this mud that clouds our mind, all of these ideas and what should I do and what shouldn't I do and when should I stop it and when should I not stop it and what's right and what's wrong, all of that settles and it's clear. Our mind becomes settled and clear and we don't have the doubts in the same way that we had before. It doesn't mean that we never have doubts. Of course, so this is not... because it's endless, and it's an endless process. It's always changing too. And so we clean the glass again. We let it settle again. But the more we are open to things as they are, the better chance we have to see things, to see the things as they are, and then know how to react. If I had my eyes blindfolded and I was walking down the street, I would not see the boy running to the street. If I were focusing only on my feet in the street, I would not see the boy running into the street. So I could not save him. Well, most of the time that's what's happening. I'm walking down the street looking at my feet. Even if I'm looking straight ahead, I'm looking at me. And I don't see what's happening around. But if I see what's happening around me, there's no doubt. It's like seeing the boy run in the street. You know how to act. It sounds like I'm making it really simple and impossible, but it's not. It's really as simple as when you're hungry, you eat. When you're thirsty, you drink water. When you're cold, you put on a jacket. When you need to go to the toilet, you go to the toilet. It's really that simple. Everything is that simple. Not easy. Not easy, but simple. That simple.
So, I think it's just because I'm curious. I don't know much about Zen and things like this. But from what I understood, what I listened, I understood that the most important is to be present, to be concentrated in the moment. Mm-hmm. And if you do that, you can go to the universe and you are open to everything. I think that is very difficult.
Because it's difficult. It's very difficult. Yeah. And the practice that I propose is radical, although it's very simple. You just sit down on a cushion and do nothing. Very simple, radical. Given this culture in which we live, as you say, very radical. Marginal. What?
In our society, you feel useless if you do nothing.
That's right.
I mean, if you sit when you are like this, you are a lazy girl, you know.
That's right.
Our education is like this. Yeah. It's like fighting against everything I've learned and you're taught.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's try it. Let's try it right now. Okay? So, sit in a comfortable position. Feet on the ground, back straight. Look down in front of you, to the back of the chair in front of you, or the floor, if you're in the front, whatever. And let your eyes just rest there. Don't focus on any given point. Just look down. Take a deep breath. Another deep breath. And then breathe in. And breathe out. Don't worry how you're breathing. Don't worry if it's fast, slow, deep, loud, doesn't matter. Just be aware of breathing. Okay. What happened? Did any? No one wants to say anything? No, I don't try not to think. No, because the function of the mind is to think. Like the function of the eyes is to see, the ears to hear. I heard sounds. I didn't try not to hear the sounds. I could see the floor, the glass table, and I let the thoughts. I just don't attach to them. I don't say, oh, I like that one. I shouldn't think that one. What do you teach? Oh. So do you ever, how old are the children?
10, 12, 13. From 10 to 13.
Hmm. And you study literature and writing and?
But the problem is the concentration and to listen to people, Israel, and so on. I think that we need to begin lessons to exercise.
Well, I ask because I have done with I've taught meditation to children, and in a classroom, it can be very powerful to just do something, not maybe as not paying attention to breath, but have, you know, the children, they just sit there and, you know, I would say listen to the rain or something, or listen to the wind, or whatever the, usually sounds are best for children, to bring their attention around, bring them right to here and now. For only a few minutes it can be, it doesn't have to be anything big. And then I've had them do writing from that, a writing exercise. It can be even small children. I did it even once when the children weren't old enough to write, and so their parents were there, and the children would tell their parents what to write, and which makes it very concrete then. And then their interest is, I'm going to listen better next time, so that I can write what I heard. You know, I'm just giving you examples of things that, But for all of us, this very simple sitting there just for a few minutes, that's, you can do that anywhere, anytime. And it's better, I'm using a judgment, to do it a few minutes regularly than to go off for a week and do it once every 2 years. You know, it's like any discipline. If you do it regularly, just for 5 minutes, it can have an effect. There will be a consequence. If only that for those 5 minutes, you experienced something you wouldn't have experienced if you had not done it for those 5 minutes. I think we're nearly out of time. Any other questions?
We need these problems to... I need to develop something within myself that makes I have to stop time between what the realities are to me and what I do back. You understand? I sometimes react too fast to what I'm getting into myself.
Yeah.
And my biggest problem right now is to stop time for about 3-4 seconds, think what I'm going to say, think what I'm going to do, and then do it. To me, that's the hardest thing to do every day. And I found an answer. It's hard every day to stop, to listen to, stop, and then come back with an answer. And I don't know if meditation is an answer or if there is any answer. But that's the hardest thing to me. And for me today, listening to you was one of the few times in my life that I had time to stop, listen, and just listen. Not to think, just listen. So I would like to thank you for that.
Thank you. Thank you. Good. If you're interested in pursuing meditation, here in Porto, every Saturday night, there are some people that sit at the Buddhist Union. Do you want to tell anything else? Do you want to say? I come to Portugal 3 times a year. Yeah, you can do it in Portuguese. Thank you. I don't know what was said, but it doesn't matter. I might also mention that I also teach in France and have a presence on the web, a blog where I teach. I don't have any architecture. So I have a virtual teaching center, which is a blog on the web, and I go in almost daily and put in small things to look at. It's in English, however. Okay, is that, you said it all? Right, thank you for listening. Thank you.
Thanks.